I think right at the beginning now, I'll give you what we should be getting into next week. We're in this section called Resurgence in Advance from AD 950 to 1350. Now, next week, we want to get into a section that Lateret calls Loss and Lassitude. Kind of descriptive terms. AD 1350 to 1500. This will pull us up to the Reformation. And we'll try to read, especially the sections on pages 601 and 624 of this area here. We'll cover it rather quickly, but this is the section then for next time. See, we finished up, we were talking about the Crusades, weren't we? And concluded with them, spiritually, they were a fiasco, weren't they? Really, spiritually, you can say, even though they start off with this, the blessing of the Pope, and here you get a plenary indulgence. If you're killed in battle, you'll go immediately to heaven, and we're going to rescue the Holy Land. We're going to conquer this for the Lord. Hopefully, we'll see the East and West churches united. This was in the papal thinking. We'll be able to once again have the church really united as it should be. If we have to, we'll do it with a sword, but we'll see it united. And this was a lot of the thinking. And yet, really, the end result was that you remember the Holy Land fell again to the Muslims, and there was no permanent gain even as far as land geographically was concerned, and that the Crusades really were a complete failure. The Greek churches resented it. For a while, you remember, they had Constantinople, but the Greek churches resented this. And as soon as they could, they cast off any even outward agreement with the Church of Rome. Now, let's look at some of the monastic movements, because they were very important during this period. And you have these monastic movements, sort of like waves almost, that rise, oftentimes, I suppose, prompted by the fact that people were so disillusioned with what they were seeing in the church. And many young men and those with higher aspirations would say, there must be something more to Christianity than this. And you'd see a new movement start, a new founder, and an attempt to somehow get back to the ideals of Christianity. Because here you're living in a supposedly Christian nation, and the bishops and the clergy are living in immorality and drunkenness, and sometimes very involved in making money. And as a result, you'd have these movements arising just as a pendulum swing really away from that. There's one movement called the Cluny movement that started north of Lyon in France. Berno, B-E-R-N-O, was the founder and the first abbot in about 910. And this became the center of a congregation of monasteries. It wasn't simply that you would just have one monastery, but you would have an association of monasteries, sort of like a denomination of monasteries, I suppose you could say. And before this time, monasteries had really been independent. But this started sort of a new movement, and in fact by 1200 there were more than 300 monasteries linked together in this federation. So that this was a new development. They followed a modified rule of Benedict of Nursia. Remember, his goal was that each monastery, and this was sort of the pattern usually followed, each monastery should be sort of self-sufficient. You'd have the monastery, you'd have its fields around, the monks would be out there working in the fields, and then they'd be having their times of prayer and devotion, and they'd have their own shops, and they were kind of a unit in themselves, sort of a little touch of Christian communism. And this modified this, so that the labor now for the fields was left to serfs. And the monks gave themselves mainly to prayer, to liturgy, to devotions. They didn't engage anymore in just manual labor, basically, which was kind of a change. And so they fell into this feudal system where a monastery now would have serfs. They'd go to the land. In other words, basically, the monastery sort of owned them as slaves. They went with the land, and they tilled the land, and the monks gave themselves now just to kind of the spiritual thing. These around Cluny, these monasteries, were not known for scholarship. They were kind of distrustful of that, of learning. Sort of the thought was, well, how can you be scholarly and really be a devout Christian? And so the emphasis here was on prayer and on devotion, on going through the various liturgies and so forth. And they did have this movement had a strong impact for about 2.5 centuries, 250 years. So it was a long time. But they had strong and able abbots, the heads of the monastery. And this movement here in France had quite an impact for a long time. Now, there's another movement that started that's called the Cistercian movement, C-I-S-T-E-R-C-I-A-N, Cistercian movement. There was a fellow named Robert, and he was a Benedictine monk, and he moved to a town called Citeaux, C-I-T-E-A-U-X. This was in eastern France. And he founded here this monastery. The Latin for Citeaux is Cistercian, and this is where the order now gets its name, the Latin name for Citeaux. They introduced some distinctive changes from the Benedictine routine. The Benedictine monks, the pattern was you always wore black. Now, they introduced different garb, and they introduced white garb, so that they stood out as being quite different. They had a tremendous stress on poverty, living very simply. They didn't want the ornate chapels that some of these other monasteries had. They wanted things very simple. Instead of having a gold crucifix, you'd have a wooden crucifix, maybe painted. But very simple. And so the emphasis here is on simple clothes and food and poverty. See, it's sort of a reaction here against what was going on amongst a lot of the clergy. Living in wealth, living in splendor in many cases. Here are these who say what the spirit of real Christianity is poverty rather than wealth. They tended to live in isolated areas. They would set up their monastery in kind of an isolated area in order to get land, virgin land, that they could begin to till, because they did not believe in having serfs. They're kind of getting back to this idea that the monks should work. So they worked their own land. And instead of following the movement of the Cluny development, they spent less time in liturgy and in prayer. You see, the Cluny movement said, let's spend our time in prayer, strong devotional emphasis, not practical at all. Whereas this movement now is kind of getting back to the old Benedictine idea that here the monks should work, and so there was time being spent in work, and you didn't just hour after hour after hour, you know, spend time reciting prayers or going over your beads or whatever. And the monasteries were linked into basically one order. There was this linking together. They had the same hymn book, and the same pattern was followed in each one, although each one was more or less under the direction of its own abbot. But these abbots would get together and they would plan together, and so they cooperated very closely together, and there was a similarity, a strong similarity amongst these. Now, the most outstanding Cistercian was Bernard of Clairvaux. And I want to read a little bit of his life. Bernard of Clairvaux. His dates, 1090 to 1153. And he's connected especially with his town in France, Clairvaux, C-L-A-I-R-V-A-U-X. He came from a noble family of Burgundy. His mother was very religious person, very devout. As each of her children were born, she dedicated them, she gave them to the Lord, and apparently with real sincerity. Now, while he was on a lonely journey, he was overwhelmed, and there were various factors entering into his life, but he was overwhelmed with the truth of God and the reality of God, and he decided to dedicate his life, to give his life to God. And he entered this convent at Citeaux in 1113. So you can see he'd be a young man then, about 23. And it shows the tremendous influence he had. They say about 30 of his friends came with him. And five brothers at the time, and I believe one other followed him later. Six of his brothers ended up in that monastery. So that you can see he had a tremendous impact on them, an influence. Now, he apparently was so ascetic and denied himself so that he abused his body until for a while he was just a skeleton. He could hardly even stand. He was so weak from fasting and from abusing himself. And later on he regretted this. He felt that it handicapped him in his service to God. He had just abused himself too much during this period of time. And he studied the scriptures, he studied the fathers, and he studied the classics a little. And in 1115, this would be a couple of years later, with 12 companions, he went off and started another monastery at Clairvaux, which is about 100 miles away from Citeaux. And this sort of became a model monastery, and during this age, Bernard was the most influential person, really, throughout Europe, religiously speaking. He had more moral authority than the Pope. He had tremendous hold over the people. And many people joined in the monastic movement through his encouragement. He did encourage the crusade movement. He was a devotional and ethical preacher, constantly emphasizing practical Christian living, and very eloquent. And he was very humble. And he's left us 250 discourses, and besides about 86 homilies on the Song of Solomon. Now, it said he performed miracles. Now, maybe this is questioned somewhat. He himself modestly admitted he had done some. And he wrote poetry. This is what we think of mainly in connection with him. And in that day, it wasn't for public use. These were devotional readings in convents and in monasteries. The medieval church was not really a singing church. People didn't sing. Actually, it's with the Reformation and following that you have really congregational singing the way we think of it today. Some of his things that he wrote, Jesus, the very thought of thee, Jesus, King most wonderful, another one. O Jesus, thou the beauty art, O sacred head now wounded. So he wrote some beautiful things. He was mystical, and there was a real tender love for the Lord. As far as his theology, he was orthodox in general. He wasn't a profound scholar. He was more a devotional mystic. And he was a good churchman. He encouraged devotion to Mary. He wasn't against this. More so to Christ, but still devotion to Mary. She's the mother of God. He believed in foot washing. Now, I believe he's a little different here in that apparently he did not think baptism was vital to salvation, although he strongly encouraged it. But the note I have here indicates that he apparently felt, basically here, faith is the vital thing. But he was very loyal in defense of the Pope and the Church. He was orthodox. He wasn't a crusader. He wasn't out trying to start a new movement or something like this. He wanted to stay in the Church. He was going to support it. And he basically upheld its beliefs. He wanted to see a moral renewal. And he wanted to see devotion to Christ within the structure. But he didn't want to see any break from it. Now, he got into kind of a tangle with Abelard. And here, he almost lost his sanctity. He got pretty bitter against him. And, for example, he called him a snake with seven heads. He called him a heretic. So he felt pretty strongly about Peter Abelard. And really fought him. But this is Bernard of Clairvaux, an outstanding man of his day, and with terrific influence during the time that he lived. Perhaps the most influential man in the Catholic Church of his time. At least as, during the time he lived, because of his life, his character, his love for the Lord. Now, in some ways, Christy, do you have a question? See, did I touch foot washing? Well, it says he believed in foot washing. Now, by this, we don't mean a Saturday night bath, but we mean the thing of John 13, where he felt the ritual itself should be preserved as something that was good for Christians to do, to go through the ceremony. You know, there are certain churches today that still practice foot washing. There are some. They regard it as, for example, on certain churches on Friday night, we'll have the Lord's Supper accompanied by foot washing. There are certain churches of the Brethren, for example, Brethren churches that do this. Now, I think we'll notice quickly a couple of the other groups that started during this period. You have four mendicant orders or friars that began during this period. Now, what's a mendicant order? When we say a mendicant, a person is a mendicant, what do we mean? All right, he's a beggar. In other words, he lives on what he gets from other people. And there were these four mendicant orders. You have the Franciscans, this is one, the Dominicans, the Carmelites, and you have the Augustinians. And these orders basically combined monastic ideals with preaching and teaching. In other words, they liked the lifestyle of the monastery, but they didn't like the isolation. They didn't want to just be withdrawn and living on some rocky peak down in the south of Italy, you know, farming their little vineyard and growing their crops and just giving themselves to prayer. They wanted to be involved in the world, but they wanted to keep some of these lifestyles and goals and ideals that the monasteries held. kind of a reaction, see, against what the clergy, basically the whole, were doing. Because during this period, you have a tremendous letdown of standards as far as the clergy were concerned, that, you know, are officiating in the local village church, this kind of thing. There, often there was terrific immorality, and the clergy were known for being covetous and wanting to live in luxury, and as a result here, there were some that would be struck by the contradiction that this had with regard to the example of Christ himself. And as a result, there was this desire for a more simple, godly type of life. And not a desire to withdraw, but to be involved in life. And so you find these orders being active in the cities. This is a period of time when cities are growing very rapidly. And Europe is kind of moving away now from the agricultural centered economy, and cities are starting to grow and develop. And these friars ministered largely in cities. They were concerned for people. They said, we want to be where the people are. We want to teach them about God and about the Bible and about the church and how to live a good life and this sort of thing. Tim?
What was the second order?
The second order were the Dominicans. D-O-M-I-N-I-C-A-N-S. Dominicans.
How did they establish churches in the city of Judy? Did they persecute them, or like in the cities?
Well, there came to be some real conflict between these orders and the established clergy. There really was in many cases, and this amazing thing is too that the jealousy and the hostility that went on between these different orders, the Franciscans and Dominicans, for example. Each one trying to build his own little kingdom and trying to get more recruits and hostile against the other and trying to have the Pope give them favors the other group doesn't have. It's a very tragic commentary on human nature, really, with all of these lofty ideals and here the petty wrangling and the petty contention and jealousies that would go on, all the rest. Very sad picture, really. But you can see a lot of it was a reaction here against the clergy who weren't doing their job. And these people, some of these men, very sincere and concerned, they'd say, well, look, here's the village priest over here, and everybody knows he's sleeping with the grocer's wife, you know, and he's got several kids running around. And there he is, and he's concerned. Look at the place he's living, and look at the luxury he lives in, and he's got better food than anyone else in the village. And there was a lot of criticism, and a lot of it was valid. Really was. I remember once being in a village in Mexico, and there was a lot of talk when we were visiting people. The people were very hostile against the priest, because they knew a teenage girl there was pregnant by him. And they were angry about it. And there was this talk. And a lot of them would say, oh, well, that's just the way it is, you know. They shrug it off. They're used to it. But yet, this has been characteristic so often. And a lot of these orders now, there was an attempt at least, even though we say in many cases, you know, there were many things that could be better. There was much that was lacking. Yet here there was some desire, somehow, let's get back to something more real and simple. Let's quit playing just the religious game, a life of hypocrisy. Now, Francis of Assisi, we'll notice first, this was his hometown, and it's a town where the Tiber River leaves the mountains in Italy and flows out onto the plains. And he was born in 1181. He had little formal education. He could read and write. And he knew a little Latin. And he knew French. Knew some French. But he really wasn't a well-educated person, formally. His name was Giovanni, which of course means John. But They gave him a nickname of Francesco, or Francis, and this is what he went by all his life. No one thinks of him as Giovanni of Assisi. You think of him as Francis of Assisi. They say he was a very warm, charming, sensitive boy. In earlier years, kind of a playboy, at least interested in the good times. I don't think anyone suggests he lived a really immoral life. He wasn't wild, but he enjoyed life. He enjoyed life. And illness and a number of circumstances in his life led him to the point where he really wanted to give his life to Christ. He began spending time out in the fields. He loved nature, so he'd spend time out alone. His father wasn't too happy about all this. He thought, well, why doesn't he work and get busy and do something worthwhile? He would love to spend time alone. He enjoyed, there was a sort of a rundown chapel where he'd like to go, and he would sit there and contemplate the crucifix and think about the love of Christ. And it was while doing this that he really felt he wanted to give his life to God. And he went ahead then in time there, and he restored that chapel. He rebuilt it and went on to restore some other broken down chapels, and had a real concern in this way. Now, his fellow townsmen thought he was crazy. He was so mystical. He wasn't practical enough, and he was withdrawing, and he'd go and he'd spend time in the fields and so forth. And his dad got very unhappy with him, and he simply wouldn't be practical. He wouldn't do what his father wanted. And so the father took him to the bishop, and he was going to disinherit him. He says, I'm through with you. You're no good. All this mooning around, wanting to sit in front of a crucifix and meditate and pray and go out in the fields and look at the birds and bees and flowers, and his dad was very unhappy with him. So Francis, in front of the bishop there, stripped off all his clothes, as were his father's, and so he stripped before the bishop, and he said, I only want to serve our Father who is in heaven from now on. So he stood there naked before the bishop and before his father, and he said, okay, you can have the clothes, they belong to you, you know. I want to serve my Father who is in heaven. It's kind of a striking scene when you think of it. And from that time on, this is what he did increasingly. Lived very simply. In 1209, he felt the call to become a traveling preacher, following Christ's example. He says, I think he just wants me to travel as he did, visit villages, preach the word. I'm going to live in poverty the way he did. Complete poverty. I'm not going to have anything except the clothes I have on. I'll live by begging. If I need to, or if there's a chance, I'll work some. And others began to follow him. Others began to do the same thing. Now, to follow him and become one of his group, you had to sell everything you had, give to the poor so you had nothing yourself, And then begin traveling and preaching. Now, he wasn't a heretic. He wasn't a rebel. He wanted to function inside the established church. So he went to the Pope and did get papal permission for their ministry. He was getting these different ones who said, we want to follow you. We want to live like Jesus. We want to just travel around and preach. And he got permission from the Pope for their ministry. Francis called them the minor or humbler brethren. He was a very humble man himself. We'll just call ourselves, he says, the minor or less. We're just the less brethren. Or we're the humbler brethren. And they lived very simply. They would beg. Or else they would, if they need to at times, they might work with their hands a little to get enough to eat. Their message was very simple. It was a practical message of love, practical Christian living. It wasn't gospel preaching in the sense of standing out and preaching the justification of God, you know, through His grace, by grace through faith. But it was more a simple message of love and trying to exhort people, you know, working within the church and assuming now everyone is a Christian, but they need to be living more devoted, simple, godly lives. And so this was their stress. And he encouraged, they strongly encouraged fasting and confession. This was the very simple way of life. Now, Francis loved nature. The story is told of how he preached to the birds. He did this at least on occasion. And I'm sure they were an appreciative audience. But he would exhort them and preach away and tell them to praise God and keep singing their songs. And I don't know if it accomplished too much. They were doing it anyway. But anyway, he loved nature. Maybe if you see pictures of him at times or statuary depicting him, you'll see him surrounded by birds or animals or things like this. He had a very real love for nature. And he covered a lot of ground. He had real missionary concern. He covered Italy pretty well. He went to Spain. He went to Egypt even in 1219 in the Fifth Crusade. He went along. He was very unhappy with the abuses of the Crusade and the immorality and all the rest, but he thought the Crusade was a good idea. And he died on October the 3rd, 1226. He was in his mid-40s. And after he died, the order became much more organized. A lot of his ideals were put aside. He had division among them, a kind of a power struggle. You had some that were called the spirituals, who just wanted to kind of hang on to that simple way of doing things. Sell everything and just go out in groups and travel and preach and then you had those who were called the moderates who wanted a more typical monastic structure and organization, and they prevailed, so that actually in time the Franciscans became more typically organized and were less and less marked by his simple ideals of no property, just living by begging and this kind of thing. But the Franciscans now were as strong and became a strong order and have carried right on through in the history of Catholicism. Now, the Franciscans really tried to convert people, if you could call it this, at least, should I say, conversion to moral living, I suppose, because they weren't trying to convert them from heathenism. They just thought everyone's a Christian. They're baptized, but you try to convert them to at least more moral, devoted living. And probably in the process, some really turned to the Lord. Really repented and turned to the Lord. You know, one of the things I think that strikes you as you go along through church history is to realize how God honored His Word even when there was a lot of confusion or maybe error mixed with it. And how in a lot of groups that are often many areas, there were some with faith. So it's good we don't have to sift out the real from the false. The Lord can do that. But this is why at times as you study, it's confusing. It's hard to know. You say, well, boy, some of this is good and some of it, wow, are they off in that area? You know? And as you think of the devotion of some of them, you feel, well, there's somebody who really knew the Lord. And yet there are some things you could hardly encourage. For example, we sing Bernard of Clairvaux's hymns, but most of us don't encourage devotion to Mary as such. We couldn't endorse all of his theology. And so I think that you just have to, as you go along, realize, well, the Lord blesses and He honors His Word wherever there's any little glimmer of faith. He delights in that and praise the Lord, there are people saved that are really have, of course, along with their salvation, some very confusing ideas, erroneous ideas. Now, let's look at the Dominicans here rather briefly. They are called the Order of Preachers or Preaching Brothers. And they're named basically after Dominic. He was born in Castile, Spain in 1170. 1170. So you can see he's a little bit older than Francis. And as he grew up, he became an Augustinian canon in one of the cathedral schools, so he was very active in church life. They say of his personality in that he was a very humble man, very ascetic, self-denying, a very gentle kind of man, apparently, and a joyful man. A man who seemed to be marked by joy. He had contact at various times with Francis and with his movement, and these influenced him. Now, he was drawn very much to certain things that Francis and those who followed him believed in. Now, he too went through official channels, and he gained papal approval for this new order in 1215, so that they could become an officially approved order. You see, the popes were a little uneasy about all these groups starting up. They wanted to control the thing. They wanted to keep the thing unified. And there were, during this period, there were a lot of roving preachers, and the guy just sort of start up his own thing and go around to the group of followers, and kind of like a guru with his followers going along, and they'd go into a town and start preaching or this kind of thing. And sometimes some of them were very heretical as far as the Catholic Church was concerned, as far as the Pope. So there was very real concern to kind of control this thing. So the way to get to cooperate was to get papal approval, and then he would approve more or less your constitution, how you're going to function. And then you could go ahead and you could say, well, we've got, you know, papal okay. Now we can really go ahead and we can function. And so the Dominicans did this. Gained papal approval for the new order in 1215. And they too became mendicant preachers. Now, they have a different flavor from the Franciscans. The Franciscans mostly recruited from poorer people. Most of those who became Franciscans were from the poorer classes that were attracted and went along with this. Whereas the Dominicans appealed more to the aristocracy. They tended to get those who were better educated. And their stress, in fact, was on scholarship and on teaching, much more so than the Franciscans. Well, Francis himself, you see, wasn't very well educated, really. And it was more his personal devotion and so forth that marked the order. And he sort of set the pace and tone of it for a long time. But especially in the early days here, the Dominicans were more marked by scholarship and by learning, and they didn't put down education at all. They encouraged it. In fact, while you could say the Franciscans tried to appeal to people and win people by, should we say, their quality of life, their self-denial, their poverty, and their love and this sort of thing, that the Dominicans tried to influence people more through their teaching. Their big stress was on teaching the word. So they got into positions of teaching wherever they could. The Dominican order. And emphasized a turning to the Lord in a more devoted way through mental persuasion, through teaching. And this was a very strong stress there of the Dominicans. Now, let me read the life of one or two men here. And I think we'll touch quickly on Gregory the Seventh, who is a very, no, he was a Pope. Yes. Now we're going to just touch quickly on Gregory the Seventh, who was a Pope from 1073 to 1085. And And his name was Hildebrand originally. He was the son of a peasant, probably of Germanic origin. And his early life is rather obscure. He entered a convent at Rome, and he developed an enthusiastic veneration for Mary. Later he joined a monastery at Cluny and became a prior of the convent. They say he was kind of small. He wasn't a very impressive man, naturally speaking, but he had fiery eyes and a fiery spirit. He had quite an active part in counseling popes that preceded him. You have Bruno becoming a pope in 1049, and he became Leo the Ninth, and Hildebrand was his counselor. And from that time on, Hildebrand really was the ruling spirit of the papacy. He was the one, even though there were other popes, he was the one who was the power sort of behind the scenes. Schaff said he understood the art of ruling through others and making them feel that they ruled themselves. So there were several popes there that basically Hildebrand was the power here in the papacy for quite a time. Now he began sort of a moral reformation of the papacy. He hated the sale of church offices, the sale of church benefits, of indulgences, things like this that were going on. And he hated the immorality of the clergy. So he began fighting this. And during this process, he became a cardinal and traveled widely in the church's interest. Now, Leo died in 1054, and then Hildebrand got Victor II elected in 1055. And there are several others. I don't know if we'll mention these, but through these, behind them, Hildebrand is very much a strong force. Now, you have Alexander II, who was pope from 1061 to 73. And he also warred against corruption. There was an attempt here to just try to lift the moral standards of the clergy. And when Alexander II died, the people were all shouting, "Hildebrand shall be the pope." It was just a terrific wave of popular enthusiasm. "We want Hildebrand." And they hurried through the legal requirements, the cardinals and all giving their assent. But there was tremendous acclamation of him. And he didn't particularly want it. He could have been the pope earlier, but he seemed in many ways to prefer just to kind of be the man behind the scenes. And he didn't care who was up there front. He just liked to help make decisions, you know, and run the thing. So that you have him here being a tremendous influence. Now he's 60 years old. Now, there are two features of Gregory. He emphasized the absolute power of the pope, and he emphasized moral reform. He quoted Augustine, and he quoted these Isidorian decretals to bolster church authority. He was very, very strong in this way. He was the strongest pope thus far as far as emphasizing the power of the papacy and exercising it. He lived for this, the power of the papacy. He exercised more authority over temporal powers than any other pope, as far as kings were concerned. It wasn't simply over ecclesiastical powers. Gregory says, as Christ's vicar on earth, since the spiritual is higher than the temporal, The spiritual ought to be able to control the temple. I am more important than any king. And the episcopal dignity, he said, is above the king, as heaven is above earth. And he's constantly appealing, of course, to Matthew 16 and 18 and 19, and the power here given to Peter. Now, he had a great battle with Henry IV in 1075, and the fight was really over the bestowal of ecclesiastical authority in these countries. You see, because the bishops and archbishops and that were almost like secular rulers also, the king says, well, look, I want to say who's going to be over this village or over this town or over this area. But the pope said, no, I'm the one. I'm the head of the church. The church owned half the land, so the kings wanted power over. And they wanted to appoint these rulers. They said they're not simply church rulers. They're running half the country, and they were. But here Gregory says, no, sir. I am the head. And there was a tremendous fight that went on. Henry deposed Gregory. He in his letter he wrote, Henry, king, not by usurpation, but by God's holy ordinance to Hildebrand, not a pope, but a false monk. How dare you, who has won your power through craft, flattery, bribery, and force, stretch forth your hand against the Lord's anointed, despising the precept of the true pope, St. Peter, fear God, honor the king. Thou who dost not fear God, dishonorest me whom he has appointed. I, Henry, by the grace of God, king with all my bishops, say unto thee, come down, come down. He sends his letter to the pope. So on February 22nd, Gregory excommunicates him. He deposes Henry. He says, down with Henry. Nobody has to obey him. He's not king at all. Now, Henry's nobles put pressure on him to seek absolution. He says, boy, this is getting bad. So Henry, in 1077, during January 25th to the 28th, he stood outside the pope's castle, begging mercy. There was snow on the ground, it was cold, and he stood there with a bare hand, head, and bare feet in a coarse tunic for 3 days, asking the pope for mercy. And so the pope, after this humiliation, when he was allowed inside, he fell at the feet of the pope saying, spare me, Holy Father, spare me. And so he was forgiven at last, and this was the high point, really, of church authority, when here you have the king of the greatest empire, really, in the West, at the feet of the Pope, pleading for mercy.